This is BFBS broadcasting from London.
We present Ian Carmichael as Lord Peter Wimsey in Murder Must Advertise by Dorothy L. Sayers, adapted for radio by Alistair Beaton. With Alan Cuthbertson as Chief Inspector Parker, John Quentin as Mr. Ingleby, Richard O'Callaghan as Mr. Willis, and Edward D'Souza as Mr. Tallboy. Episode 2. Singular Spotlessness of a Lethal Weapon.
Victor Dean, a young copywriter with Pym's Publicity Limited, has died in mysterious circumstances. To investigate suspicions of murder, Lord Peter Wimsey has taken employment with Pym's, posing as a new copywriter by the name of Breeden. Despite protest by his brother-in-law, Chief Inspector Charles Parker, that there is nothing strange about the death, Lord Peter Wimsey continues his investigations.
Hello, hello, hello. What ho, Ingleby? Where have you been hiding, Breeden?
Fighting Tallboy, I expect. He's on your tail. He wants that New Tracks headline. Now you know what it's like working on the New Tracks copy.
I have been up on the roof. Cooler and all that, don't you know?
I don't. It must be like a gridiron up there.
Ah, so it is, old lad, so it is. But I thought I'd just try it, what? As a matter of fact, I was chucking pennies over the parapet of that brass band. I got the bombardon twice. The penny goes down with a tremendous whack, you know, and they look up all over the place to see where it comes from when you dodge down behind the parapet. It's a tremendously high parapet, too, ain't it? I suppose they wanted to make the building look higher than it is. It's the highest in the street, in any case. Earth hath not anything to show more fair. It's going to rain like Billy O'Toole in about 2 ticks. See how black he's come over?
You seem to have come over pretty black if it comes to that. Look at the seat of your trousers.
You do want a lot, Ingleby. It's a bit sooty up there, that's all. I was sitting on the skylight.
Look as if you've been shinning up a pipe.
Well, I did shin down a pipe. Only one pipe. Rather a nice pipe, actually. It took my fancy.
You're loopy. Doing acrobatics on dirty pipes, whatever made you?
I dropped something. I went down onto the glass roof of the wash place. Nearly put my foot through. Oh, wouldn't old Hankin have been surprised if I'd tumbled into the wash basin on top of him? I then found I needn't have gone down by the pipe after all. I came back by the staircase. The roof door was open on both floors.
Yes, they generally keep them open in hot weather.
Well, I wish I'd known.
You know, if you keep on like this, it's you who'll need to be nourishing your nerves with New Tracks. And by the way, is that New Tracks half-double ready yet? You do realize it's Tuesday. If it's not ready today, it won't be in time for Friday's Morning Gazette.
Everything's under control, Ingleby, fear not. Oh, gosh, it's hot. I could do with a drink.
Have a glass of sparkling Pompeii.
What's that?
Oh, one of Brotherhood's non-alcoholic refreshers. Made from finest Devon apples with a crisp, cool sparkle of champagne. Definitely anti-rheumatic. Doctors recommend it.
Ugh. I think this is an awfully immoral job of ours. I do, really. Think how we spoil the digestion of the public.
Ah, yes, but think how earnestly we strive to put them right again. We undermine them with one hand and build them up with the other. The vitamins we destroy in the canning, we restore in Revito. The roughage we remove from Peabody's Piper Parish, we make up into a package and market as Bunbury's breakfast bran. The stomachs we ruin with Pompeii, we reline with peplets to aid digestion. And by forcing the damn fool public to pay twice over, once to have its food emasculated and once to have the vitality put back again, we keep the wheels of commerce turning and give employment to thousands, including you and me.
Ah, say, that was a good one. I do adore thunderstorms. By the way, what has Willis got against me?
Well,
he seems to think that I'm not nice to know.
I warned you not to talk to him about Victor Dean. He seems to have got it into his head that you were a friend of his or something.
But what was wrong with Dean?
He kept bad company. Why are you so keen to know about Dean anyway?
Well, I suppose I'm just naturally inquisitive. I always like to know about people. About the office boys, for instance. They do physical jerks on the roof, don't they? Is that the only time they're allowed up there?
Absolutely. Otherwise, strict out of bounds.
I just wondered. They're a mischievous lot, I expect. Boys always are. Well, I like them, you know, I like them. What's the name of the red-headed one? He looks a snappy lad.
Yeah, that's Joe. They call him Ginger, of course. What's he been doing?
Oh, nothing. I expect you'll get a lot of cats prowling about this place.
Cats? I've never seen any cats. Except I believe there's a cat that lives in the canteen, which doesn't seem to come up here. What do you want a cat for?
Yeah, I don't. Anyway, there must be dozens of sparrows, mustn't there?
Breeden, I do think the storm has affected your brain. Do you know that?
But what I want to know is, Peter, who saw him die?
I said the fly. Meaning those who saw the fall from below and those who saw it from above. Their evidence is interesting. Some say that the staircase was well lit and that the deceased was not going extra fast, while others say that he fell all of a heap, forwards, clutching the Times Atlas in so fierce a grip that it could hardly be prized from his fingers. Now, what does that suggest you, Charles?
Only that the death was instantaneous, which it would be if one broke one's neck.
I know that, but look here. You are going downstairs and your foot slips. Now, what happens? Do you crumple forwards and dive down head first? Or do you sit down suddenly on your tail and do the rest of the journey that way?
Oh, it depends, Peter. If it was actually a slip, well, I should come down on my tail. But if I tripped, I should very likely dive forwards. You can't tell without knowing just how it happened.
All right, Charles, you always have an answer. Well, now, do you clutch what you're carrying with a deathly grip? Or do you chuck it and try to save yourself by grabbing hold of the banisters?
Well, I should probably grab, unless I was carrying a tray full of crockery or anything. And even then, I don't know. Perhaps it's an instinct to hold on to what one's got. But equally, it's an instinct to try to save oneself. All this arguing about what you and I would do and what the reasonable man would do is very unsatisfactory.
Put it this way, Doubting Thomas. If the death grip was due to instantaneous rigor, he must have been dead so quickly that he couldn't think of saving himself. Now, there are two possible causes of death. The broken neck, which he must have got when he pitched on his head at the bottom, and the crack on the temple, which is attributed to his hitting his skull on one of the knobs of the banisters. Now, falling down a staircase isn't like falling off a roof. You do it in installments and have time to think about it. If he was killed by hitting the banisters, he must have fallen first and hit himself afterwards. The same thing applies with still more force to his breaking his neck. Why then, when he felt himself going, didn't he drop everything and break his fall?
Whimsy, I know what you want me to say, that he was sandbagged first and dead before he fell, but I don't see it. I say he would have caught his toe in something and tripped forwards and struck his head straight away and died of that. Well, there's nothing impossible about that.
Then I will try again. How is this? That same evening, Mrs. Crump, the head charwoman, picked up this onyx scarab in the passage just beneath the iron staircase. It has, as you also see, a slight chip on one side. It belonged to the dead man, who was accustomed to carrying it in his waistcoat pocket or keep it sitting on his desk beside him while he worked. Now, what about that?
I should say it fell from his pocket when he fell.
And the chip in it?
It was probably there before.
It wasn't. Pamela told me it wasn't.
Pamela?
Pamela Dean, Victor Dean's sister.
Oh, yes. Then the scarab got chipped in falling.
You think that?
I do.
I think you were meant to think that. To continue, some few days earlier, the same dear woman found a smooth pebble of much the same size as the scarab lying in the same passage at the foot of the same iron staircase.
Did she? Will you care for a scotch, Peter?
Thank you. Yeah. What's more, this other pebble, which I here produce, was found by me on the roof of the lavatory. I had to shin down a pipe to get it and ruined a perfectly good pair of flannel bags. I also found a place where the paint had been chipped off the skylight.
What skylight? Here.
Thank you. The skylight that is directly over the iron staircase. It's one of those pointed things, like a young greenhouse, and it has windows that open all around. You know the kind of thing. The kind which are kept open in hot weather. It was hot weather the day young Dean departed this life.
The idea being that somebody heaved a stone at him through the skylight?
To be exact, not a stone, but the stone. Meaning the scarab.
And how about the other stones?
Practice shots. I've ascertained that the office is always practically empty during the lunch hour. Nobody much goes up on the roof except Ginger and his friends.
Ginger and his friends?
I'm sorry, the office boys, don't you know. They have their PJs up on the roof at 8:30 a.m.
People who live in glass skylights shouldn't throw stones. Do you mean to suggest that by chucking a small stone like this at a fella, you're going to crack his skull open and break his neck for him?
Not if you just throw it, of course.
Eh?
Come in. Ah, Ginger.
You wanted to see me, Mr. Breeden, sir?
Yes, Ginger, I did. Come in and close the door earlier, would you?
Oh, yes. Sorry, sir.
Ginger, is this your catapult?
Oh, yes, it is, sir.
It's a good one. Make it yourself?
Yes, sir.
Good shot with it?
Pretty fair, sir.
Like to have it back?
Yes, please, sir. Did you get it from...
Ah, that is my business, Ginger. I gather it was confiscated.
Well, we ain't supposed to carry them sort of things in our uniform pockets, sir. But I got caught, like, and it was confiscated.
Confiscated?
Yes.
How long ago was it confiscated?
Bit over a month it would be, sir. About the middle of May.
And you've never laid hands on it since?
No, sir.
Have you any other catapult?
No, sir.
Did you ever shoot with this, or any other catapult, on the roof?
On the roof of the office, sir?
Yes.
No, sir.
Or anybody else that you know of?
No, sir.
Are you absolutely sure?
Nobody that I know of, sir.
All right. What was that book I saw you reading yesterday, Ginger?
The Clue of the Crimson Star, sir. About Sexton Blake. He's a detective, you know, sir.
Like detective stories, Ginger?
Oh, yes, sir. I read a lot of them. I'm going to be a detective one day, sir.
Well, the first thing a detective has to learn to do is to keep his mouth shut. You know that.
Yes, sir.
If I show you something now, Ginger, can you keep quiet about it?
Oh, yes, sir.
Right. Now we will see whether your catapult can tell us anything about its adventures since it left your hands.
Cool. Are you going to test the catapult for prints?
I am.
Is that why you're holding it, all wrapped up in that handkerchief, then? So as not to put your own prints on it.
Quite correct, Ginger. Now, with the aid of some powder and an insufflator, it'll be interesting to see if we find any prints. And still more interesting if we find none. Not a single print. Ginger, what do you, as a detective, deduce from that?
Somebody must have wiped it clean, sir.
And why should anyone do that?
So that the police couldn't fix nothing on them, sir.
The police, eh?
Well, sir, the police, or a detective, or somebody like as it might be yourself, sir.
I can find no fault with that deduction, Ginger. Can you go further and say why this unknown catapult artist should have gone to all that trouble?
No, sir.
Oh, come.
Well, sir, it ain't as though he stole it. And besides, it ain't worth nothing.
No. Then it looks as though somebody has borrowed it if he didn't steal it. Now, who could do that?
I don't know, sir.
Do you realize, Ginger, that a thing like this might easily kill anybody if it happened to catch him in just the right spot?
Kill anybody? Would it, sir?
Well, I wouldn't like to try the experiment. You're quite sure, Sonny, that nobody you know of was larking about with this catapult the day that Mr. Dean fell downstairs?
No, sir. Wish I may die, sir. I never see nothing of that. You don't think somebody catapulted Mr. Dean, sir?
Detectives never think anything, Ginger. They collect facts and make deductions. God forgive me. Can you remember who might have happened to be standing round or passing by when Mrs. Johnson took that catapult from you and put it on her desk?
I couldn't say right off, sir. I never saw her put it away. Excuse me, sir. Are you from Scotland Yard, sir?
No, I'm not from Scotland Yard. Well, thank you for your help, Ginger. And mum's the word, remember?
What horses, sir? What horses?
Breeden here. As in summertime on.
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Breeden, sir.
Yes?
There's a Miss Pamela Dean to see you, Mr. Breeden.
May I speak to her, please?
Hello, Mr. Breeden. Pamela Dean here. I got your letter this morning. Shall I come up?
No, don't do that. You oughtn't to have come here, you know. It's a little indiscreet, but, well, how about honouring me by taking in a spot of lunch with me, what?
Oh, yes, thank you. I'd be delighted.
Splendid, splendid. I'll join you in a jiffy. But you see, Miss Dean, the letter by itself proves absolutely nothing. Spot more coffee?
Oh, no, thank you. But you agree that it's very strange that my brother should have begun some kind of warning letter 10 days before he was killed on that stairway.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Extremely strange. Mm. But that doesn't prove that he was killed. It's all darn suspicious, but the fall down the iron staircase could still turn out to be an accident. Mm. What interests me now is your brother's connection with the bright young things.
Oh, you mean Diane de Momery and her crowd?
Yes. Victor introduced you to that set, didn't he?
Yes, I suppose so. But I never really got involved with them the way Victor did.
Nevertheless, you do know the fair Diane, do you not?
Oh, yes.
Splendid. I want to make contact with her, and I need your help. First of all, get the name of Breeden circulating a bit. Tell the bright Diane that I am a most mysterious person. Hint that I am often miles away in Paris or Vienna or anywhere that sounds fruity. You can convey the right impression, I know. Philip Oppenheim with a touch of Ethel M. Dell and Eleanor Glynn.
All right. I could get you into Diane's next party. It's a fancy dress affair.
Excellent. Splendid, indeed. Yes, I shall go as, a harlequin. Yes, I rather fancy being a harlequin. With a mask, of course. Must have a mask, what? I say, will you excuse me for just a moment?
Oh, yes, of course.
I think I've spotted a familiar face at the next table, skulking behind a newspaper. Hello? Well, if it isn't a fellow refugee from Pym's publicity. How are you, dear Mr. Willis? Enjoyed your lunch? What an extraordinary coincidence that you should also choose to eat at Simpson's today. Excellent saddle of mutton, what? But you should have tried the peas. Can I give you a lift back to the treadmill?
No, thanks, Breeden.
Miss Dean unhappily has to leave us. Who might come and console me by holding my hand?
Well, it is getting a bit late. If you're having a taxi, I'll share it with you.
Ah, that's the stuff. Miss Dean, I think you know our Mr. Willis.
Oh, yes. Victor and he were great friends at one time. I must be getting along now. Thank you so much for my lunch, Mr. Breeden. And you won't forget.
I certainly will not. It isn't likely, is it?
Good afternoon, Mr. Willis.
Good afternoon, Miss Dean.
Pretty kid, young Dean's sister.
See here, Breeden. I don't know quite what your game is, but you better be careful. I told Dean, and I tell you. If you get Miss Dean mixed up with that dirty business of yours...
What dirty business?
You know well enough what I mean.
Perhaps I do. And what then? Do I get my neck broken like Victor Dean?
You'll get... You never mind. You'll get what's coming to you. I'll see to that.
I have no doubt that you'll do it very competently too, Mr. Willis. But do you mind telling me exactly where you come into all this? From what I can see, Miss Dean does not seem to welcome your championship with any great enthusiasm.
Now, look here.
It is no business of mine, of course, but then, on the other hand, it doesn't seem to be any business of yours, does it?
It is my business. It is every decent man's business. That's why I followed you to the restaurant.
What a detective you would make, Mr. Willis. But you really ought to take care when you're shadowing anybody that they're not sitting opposite a mirror or anything that will serve as a mirror. There is a picture in front of the table where you were sitting that reflects half the room. Elementary, my dear Watson. No doubt you will do better with practice. However, there's no secret about the appointment. We are going to a fancy dress affair on Friday. I'm meeting Miss Dean for dinner at Boulassin's at 8 o'clock, and we're going on from there. Oh, well, here we are at our little home from home. We must put aside this light badinage and devote ourselves to Soppo and Pompin and Peabody's Piper Parish. A delightful occupation, though somewhat lacking in incident. But let us not complain. We can't expect battle, murder, and sudden death more than once a week. By the way, where were you when Victor Dean fell downstairs?
In the lavatory.
Were you indeed? In the lavatory?
You interest me strangely, Mr. Willis.
Copywriter is perfectly potty.
Potty, Miss Meatyard? How do you mean potty?
Well, loopy, goofy, blah. He's always up on the roof playing with a catapult. I don't know what Mr. Hankin was saying.
Mr. Tallboy, you are the group manager. Surely you can stop members of the staff from cavorting about on the roof with catapults?
I'm sure I don't know what you mean, Mr. Hankin.
Of course you do. Willis told me that Breeden's been ranting and raving about taking pot shots at sparrows. Do you think the man's quite stable?
Yes. I mean, his work is very promising, isn't it?
Yes. His work, on the whole, is more promising than his behaviour.
I tell you, Ingleby, I'm fed up with Breeden. If he's not poking his nose into other people's affairs, he's playing silly games with catapults. Even Garrett's been gossiping about it, and you know how little interest he takes in the world about him.
Curious chap, Breeden. Nice enough to talk to and all that. His brain does get softer when it's hot weather.
Meatyard, I said to him, I said, Mr. Breeden, how can we expect the office boys to obey the rules?
When he's clowning around with a catapult himself.
Absolutely. I mean, if this were to reach Pym, well, he'd have every right to be angry, wouldn't he? Mm. After all, Miss Meatyard, if you're a copywriter, you're a copywriter, and the job does carry with it a certain status. And if the house is not...
Parker Bird, I think you are uncommonly lucky to be alive and ought to be jolly well thankful instead of grumbling.
You'd grumble all right with a bust collarbone and a headache like nothing on earth and the feeling as though a herd of bulls had been trampling on your tummy.
It beats me the way these policemen give way over trifling accidents. In the Sexton Blake book that my friend Ginger Joe has just lent me, the great detective, after being stunned with a piece of lead pipe in and trussed up for 6 hours, is taken by boat on a stormy night to a remote house on the coast and flung down a flight of stone steps into a cellar. At the 59th minute of the 11th hour, he is most fortunately rescued, and pausing only to swallow a few ham sandwiches and a cup of coffee, instantly joins in a prolonged pursuit of the murderers by aeroplane, during which he has to walk out along the wing and grapple with a fellow who has just landed on it with a rope. And here is my own brother-in-law, giving way to bad temper and bandages because some 3x4 crook has slugged him on his own comfortable staircase.
I'm trying to think who it could have been. It wasn't a burglar or anything like that. It was a deliberate attempt at murder. The light bulb had been put out of action beforehand, and he'd been hiding for some hours behind the coal bunker. You can see the marks of his feet. He wasn't obliging enough to leave anything behind to identify him except a Woolworth pencil.
Oh, he left a pencil, did he?
Yes, one of those pocket-propelling things. I've tried it for fingerprints, but you can't get much.
Sure.
Yes, and there was a letter for you. You know, in that postbox we rigged up here so you didn't have to give your own address to Pym's publicity.
A letter?
Damn, I can't find it. I distinctly remember putting it in my jacket pocket. I know it was there. One of those fancy, long-shaped mauve envelopes with gilt edges and a lady's fist, rather sprawling.
It's gone, has it? That's very remarkable. So it must have been somebody who knew I'd taken a flat above yours, pro tem. And what's more, Charles, this ain't a Woolworth's pencil. It's one of Darling's.
Same thing. Anyone might carry one of them.
No, not so. This is where my expert knowledge comes in. Darlings don't sell these pencils, they give them away. Anybody buying more than a pound worth of goods gets a pencil as a good conduct prize. You observe that it carries an advertising slogan. It isn't dear, it's Darlings. One of Pym's best efforts, by the way.
Well, that's very helpful, Peter. It ought to be easy to identify a criminal who's bought a pound's worth of goods at Darlings within the last 6 months or so.
Wait a bit. This pencil, a natty scarlet, as you will observe, didn't come from any of Darling's branches, because it's not on the market yet. Ergo, there are only 3 places it could have come from. 1 from the pencil manufacturers, 2 from Darling's head office, and 3 from our place.
Do you mean Pym's?
I do. Darling's obligingly presented us with half a gross of them to try out.
Good Lord.
I think it is highly unlikely that you have a deadly enemy at the pencil manufacturers or at Darling's head office. It seems to me much more likely that the gentleman with the cosh, or knuckle duster, or sandbag, or lead piping, in short, the blunt instrument, came from Pym's, guided by your address, which, with your usual amiability, you kindly allowed me to give as mine. Observing my name neatly inscribed on the letterbox of flat 4, he mounted confidently on...
Well, I'm dashed. Do you mean to say it's really you who ought to be lying here, mangled and bruised?
I think so, Charles. I certainly do think so. Particularly as the assailant seems to have walked off with my private correspondence. I know who, or to be more grammatical, whom their letter was from, by the way.
Oh, yes. Whom?
From Pamela Dean, to be sure. I recognize your description of the envelope.
Pamela Dean, the victim's sister?
As you say.
Willis's young woman?
Precisely.
But how should he know about the letter?
I don't suppose he did. I rather fancy this is the result of a little bit of self-advertisement that I put in at the office. I made it clear to all and sundry that I had been experimenting on the roof with the catapult. I thought I might get some reaction. What a pity it reacted on you and not on me.
Yes, Peter. A very great pity.
In that episode of Murder Must Advertise, the parts were played as follows. Lord Peter Wimsey, Ian Carmichael, Chief Inspector Parker, Alan Cuthbertson, Mr. Ingleby, John Quentin, Mr. Willis, Richard O'Callaghan, Mr. Tallboy, Edward D'Souza, Mr. Hankin, Frank Williams, Miss Meachyard, Frances Jeter, Miss Rossiter, Joanna Wake, Pamela Dean, Amanda Murray, and Ginger, Greg Mandel. Murder Must Advertise was adapted by Alistair Beaton from the book by Dorothy L. Sayers. The program was produced by Martin Fisher.